since every election ever, and beer.
Well, you just heard Scott with our intro again. But again, he is not here. He's on vacation. I'm wondering when Eddie and I get our paid vacation leave.
Right? What's up with that?
You know, Scott comes prepared every once in a while when we actually are in front of people and he can be embarrassed.
I know. It's actually really bad when that happens because then the show goes on for like an hour and a half.
Yeah, we were getting really tired that last time. I remember that for sure. Troy Suggs also isn't here, who helped us out last time. It is just you and I.
Just you and I.
Just you and I.
Fantastic.
Now that that's over, that little heartfelt moment, tell me what you're drinking today, because I have no idea.
You know what? Sadly, I am beerless today.
Oh, really?
I had the flu this week.
Oh, wow.
And you can still get the flu in this country, it turns out. I thought for sure I had COVID, but I just have the flu.
It was the flu instead.
So I'm on flu medicine, and I haven't had a beer in a week.
So it was just the flu, not the Kung flu, is what you're saying.
Right. It was not the Kung flu.
I wish I could say that I have two beers because you have none, but everybody knows I do not like beer enough to do that. But I do have one, and it's the closest I could get to relating to this election. It's back to a beer I got from Colorado, from my friend Cassie in Colorado. It is from a place called Breckenridge Brewery. And because the candidate is George H.W. Bush this time around, I'm drinking a vanilla porter because he's about as vanilla of a candidate as you can actually get, I think.
Have you ever had a porter?
I have not. I'm about to drink one.
Wow. A porter is fantastic. I think you'll love it, or you probably won't.
I actually do. It tastes pretty good. I'm starting to get into the cream ales, and it's not that different. I can taste the vanilla in it, so.
Nice. What you got to do is take a really plain porter or a really plain stout, like Guinness. You got to pour half Guinness and half of one of your ciders, and I know that you'll love it because my wife loves it.
That is the favorite part of the show for some people, which is the only reason you bug me about that, I'm sure. But I will say this. I took a little trip to Gatlinburg. I think you've been to Gatlinburg, too, before.
I love Gatlinburg. Absolutely love Gatlinburg.
So Gatlinburg is close, and now they have all these distilleries and breweries up there, mostly like the moonshine and the whiskey and that sort of stuff. So I did a moonshine tasting tour at a distillery called Old Smoky. And then also, I went to a place called Tennessee Ciders and sampled all five of their ciders there. And bought one. Actually, I bought two. And I was going to drink that this show, but then I realized Scott wasn't here to make fun of me, and it would not be near as fun if you guys didn't gang up on me. So,
oh, yeah, that would be a waste of a cider.
Exactly. So I'm going to drink that whole, and I think it's like a 32-ounce. It may be a 40-ounce, like old school. I'm going to drink that whole thing and get really crunk next episode.
Well, I'm looking forward to that.
But again, it's just you and I in the election of 1988 this time around. So where do you want to start?
I thought I'd just start by saying this is actually the first election that I remember.
Okay.
I was only about 8 years old, but I can remember seeing stuff about it on TV. I can remember everybody talking about it. I can remember my parents talking about it.
Yeah. And you're right. I remember Dukakis, too. Which is odd, because normally this is the first election where I remember the person that wasn't elected, that was running against the candidate that was elected. Like, you know, Reagan, I knew who Reagan was a little bit, but not much. I was still really young, obviously, but didn't remember Mondale until I actually learned about him later in history. But Dukakis, I remembered his name at the time.
Me too.
I think you're right.
I think another interesting thing about this election is the comeback of moderate Republicanism and how it made its comeback, because you can remember, if you want to go full conservative, you have Calvin Coolidge, who became president accidentally when Harding died.
Yeah.
And then you have a very, very long gap, and then you have Ronald Reagan. There's no super conservative in between them. Like, the only person you can point to is Barry Goldwater, who got annihilated in the Electoral College, just got destroyed by LBJ. And so then after all those years, you have the Reagan Revolution. and conservatism makes it all the way to the White House.
And then disappears after that.
Yeah, and then it's there 8 years, and who comes after Reagan? Not somebody who is very conservative like Reagan was, but the person that he picked as his running mate to bring in the moderates.
Do we know, did we talk about why he picked Bush? I mean, I know he and Bush were going back and forth in the 80 election, and it was really pretty contentious at that point.
You remember the whole episode where they were going to have the debate and Ronald Reagan said, I paid for this microphone. You're not going to turn it off. These other people are going to compete. And Bush didn't want them to compete. And Reagan did.
Yeah, that was in New Hampshire. He basically paid for the debate because they weren't going to host it otherwise. And Bush only agreed to do it one-on-one. So yeah, Reagan pitched a fit, but finally, because Bush wouldn't debate otherwise, he acquiesced, and it was just he and Bush.
That's right. I think Bob Dole was one of the guys on that stage. And Bob Dole is coming.
Yeah.
He's coming.
He still runs in this election, you know?
Yeah, yeah. He's run more than one. He's run several times.
Yeah, he's one of those that we say, you know, Scott and I have talked about it on Politics, and we've all talked about it here. It's like, especially for the Republicans, you just have people waiting in line to be the next person to run for president.
What's funny about Bob Dole, he was in the news yesterday.
I saw something about him supporting President Trump, right?
Yeah, he said that the people at the nonpartisan commission for presidential debates, he said there wasn't a single Trump supporter in the whole place, that everybody was anti-Trump there.
Right, right. I remember seeing that.
And that's Bob Dole. Goes all the way back. I mean, so far back, we've been talking about him.
Yeah.
And in 96, he'll finally be the nominee, which is two episodes away.
Yep.
But so what happens is Reagan's running mate, chosen specifically to be counter to Reagan, to bring in the people who normally would not vote for a Reagan, but they say, oh, you got moderate Bush on the ticket, so yeah, I guess I'll go and vote for Reagan Bush. And he ends up ascending to Reagan's throne, if you will, because Reagan is in 84 won 49 states, which is just huge. It was the biggest landslide since FDR.
You could do better, but not much better.
yeah, you could do better, but I mean, it is a tightrope to do any better than Reagan did in 1984. And so, you know, if you're any sort of Republican in 1988, you're going to get that. But Bush, not anything like Reagan, just the anti-Reagan. One big difference between Bush and Reagan was that you could give Reagan poetry and he could deliver it like nobody else. Like if you were a speechwriter, you could write him poetry and he would deliver it like a movie actor would deliver a beautiful line.
Right.
And Reagan has tons of those beautiful lines, like when he talked about the Challenger and he said,
they kissed the sky, right? Or they kissed the face of God or something.
Yeah, I care. Yeah, they touched the face of God.
Yeah, okay.
That kind of line. I'm not sure, but I think probably Peggy Noonan wrote that. She now writes for the Wall Street Journal, but she was a big Reagan speechwriter. The Martin Trepto thing from his inauguration speech, we played that, and it's beautiful. Peggy Noonan wrote for George H.W. Bush as well, and she wrote this line for the 1988 election, 1,000 points of light.
Yep, yep.
And Bush could just literally never deliver that line.
I remember that.
He couldn't say 1,000 points of light and get it right.
Yeah, and I remember that being part of his campaign. I mean, he was not a great communicator.
Yeah, he could not deliver the poetic lines. It would be like if you tried to write a poetic line for Donald Trump to deliver. I mean, it would just get butchered because that's just not his style. It's not to denigrate President Trump, but, you know, he doesn't go out and wax poetic and bring tears to people's eyes with his poetry.
If you're gonna write for President Trump, you write like you're writing for the Friars Roast or
that's right.
Yo Mama jokes or something like that. That's his wheelhouse.
That's right.
Let me ask you this. You may be going to get to this. Are you going to get to the Saturday Night Live stuff, or am I jumping ahead?
No, go ahead. Let's do it.
So
I think it would be prudent at this juncture.
It would be prudent.
Not going to do it. Wouldn't be prudent.
Is that
this juncture
the most iconic political impersonation still ever? It has to be in the top two or three from Saturday Night Live. With all the presidents we've had after, it's still got to be. It's probably the one you name when you talk about, hey, let's name a president that they, you know, impersonated from Saturday Night Live and name who did it.
What do you think is the best one ever? Do you think Bush is the best one ever by Dana Carvey?
I think that's the best. I really do. I mean, I love Will Ferrell playing, you know, W, but that's just kind of goofy. And, you know, Phil Hartman playing Clinton when he runs into the McDonald's and all that kind of stuff was hilarious, too. And I can't stand Alec Baldwin playing Trump. I just...
Oh, God, I think it's the funniest. I think that's the best one there's ever been.
You know why I don't like it? I don't like Alec Baldwin at all.
Oh, I hate Alec Baldwin.
Yeah, and I just can't. I can't stomach watching it.
Oh, my gosh, I can't believe that. I think it's the funniest one. I think he's so good at it. I thought Jim Carrey sucked big time as Joe Biden, but dang, I think that Alec Baldwin doing Donald Trump is hilarious.
I need to watch it because I've refused. I just...
You know, like, I went into it thinking this is going to suck, and then I saw him do it, and I was like, wow, man, he nailed it.
Nailed it. Let's put that up for a... We'll put that up for a poll on Twitter then. Which is your favorite
one?
Yeah,
let's do it.
And really, it'll be those two. We might include a couple more, but those have to be close to one and two then, I would think.
Yeah, I think that Dana Carvey as George H.W. Bush is second best after that.
I think I remember, where did Dana Carvey do Bush for Bush? I remember seeing that.
Oh, God. Yeah, he got invited to the White House, and he has this whole bit in his stand-up act where he says, and I'm sitting there with George Bush, and he says, you know, I heard you do a really funny impression of me. I understand it's very amusing. Why don't you call the Secret Service guy in here? His name is Dave. And Dana Carvey says it. So I said, Dave, could you come in here a second? And Bush thought it was real funny, so he picked up the red phone and said, let's try it on the premier of China. He says, so I called the premier of China, and I said, do you have any Mushu chicken?
Not sure that could be done today, but it's still funny. But anyway, yeah, he was just, I mean, that when you think of H.W. Bush, you really can't separate him now from Dana Carvey's impersonation of him. It's just, they're so tied together.
It's hard, and it's weird that there's going to be a whole Bush dynasty that all stems from this guy who never could have won the presidency on his own. He won only because of Reagan's coattails.
Right.
Like, he never could have gotten to the presidency on his own. He wasn't particularly likable. He wasn't particularly a big character, a big personality. He wasn't one of these guys who walks into a room and just owns it, like, with presence. He wasn't any of those things. He jumped on Reagan's coattails, and he ended up becoming president on Reagan's popularity and not his own.
This is the classic case of wanting to not change the current course, wanting to stay with the status quo and not trusting to bring in some new candidate. You're basically just making the third term of Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, that's generally been disastrous in American history.
That's what I was going to say.
So other ones that jump out at, like, off the top of my head, John Adams taking over after 8 years of George Washington, Taft taking over after 8 years of Theodore Roosevelt.
Okay, so here's a trivia question for you. Bush became the first sitting vice president to be elected since...
Oh, that's the first sitting vice president to be elected. Let me do it. All right, let's go back. Nixon lost, so it's not him. So we got to go back further than Ike. We got to go back further than FDR. We got to go back further than... Taft was not vice president. He was Secretary of War. So we go back further than that. Jeez.
You got to go way back.
It must be Thomas Jefferson.
Not that far back.
Not that far back. Okay. Oh, Martin Van Buren.
Ding, ding, ding. You nailed it. The first sitting vice president to be elected since Martin Van Buren in 1836.
I can't believe I forgot Van Buren.
And the thing is, he's one of those third termers, right, that kind of was a bust.
Yeah, Martin Van Buren was another one. I knew there was somebody else.
When you don't really follow these elections closely and you don't listen to our show every week, you would almost think that the vice presidency is really the stepping stone, and it's almost a formality if you want to be the next president. And we've seen that that's not always the case.
Absolutely not.
Right.
You know, it sort of became that for a little bit after Bush, because then after Bush, you have Al Gore after 8 years of Clinton who runs.
I'm assuming you're going to get into the general election a little bit.
Yeah. You got the primary for us.
Yeah, let me talk a little bit about the primaries, and there's not much to talk about.
Oh, let me introduce it.
Yeah, go ahead.
And now, Matt Webb brings you Primary Focus.
I appreciate that. It's been several episodes since we've even had a Primary Focus, mostly because Eddie's forgotten to introduce me. But I'm back. We've not been canceled. The Republican primary is really not much of a primary. We were talking a little bit before the show about, you know, who was actually kind of names thrown out there. H.W. Bush, the vice president for Reagan, is the presumptive nominee, sort of leading from the beginning. You have the only other, I guess, significant possibility for a candidate out there is Bob Dole, senator from Kansas, who, by the way, another great SNL impersonation of Bob Dole.
Yeah, somebody played him, and it was funny.
I think it was Norm MacDonald.
Oh, was it really? Norm MacDonald is so funny. I love him. He's one of my favorite people ever on Saturday Night Live.
I think so. I think it was him. And you had also Pat Robertson was in this primary. He won four states. The interesting part of the primary process is what was called on some of these news programs that I watched from back in the day preparing for this, the affair scandal of the decade. And that was presumptive nominee and front runner in the Democratic primary, Gary Hart, senator from Colorado. We know about him because he was a pretty serious candidate in 84 when Mondale ended up getting nominated, the whole where's the beef thing and all that stuff. So he gets embroiled in this affair scandal that involves a model from Miami named Donna Rice. And the way this all goes down is he meets her at, believe it or not, a party hosted by someone she was dating at the time, the lead singer or one of the lead singers and the drummer of the Eagles, Don Henley. At a party Don Henley was hosted, Gary Hart happened to be there and met her. She says in an interview with Barbara Walters, who she gave an exclusive interview to that year, that she met him again in Miami later and it was just a coincidence. But she ends up on a Democratic supporters' boat with Gary Hart, and they end up taking what was supposed to be a day trip to an island that turns into an overnight trip. She has a friend on there who asks her to pose with Gary Hart for pictures, and they use Donna Rice's camera. But the friend keeps asking for copies of the pictures. And one of the most famous pictures is Donna Rice sitting on Gary Hart's lap on some island. And those pictures, once they're given by Donna Rice to her friend to borrow, somehow find their way to the tabloids. And she also places, they think now, what was an anonymous call to the Miami Herald to say that Gary Hart is lying about not being a philanderer. And he is committing infidelity, and one of the people he's committing it with is Donna Rice. The Miami Herald stakes out Gary Hart's Washington apartment. And basically, they surround it to try to catch Donna Rice leaving the apartment. And they question Gary Hart about it. He denies it. He denies it for a couple of weeks, holds this insanely uncomfortable press conference where he's asked for 45 to 50 minutes direct questions about an affair and infidelity from the press, and he's answering all these, you know, off the cuff. And it's really a three-week downfall of the candidate with the most potential in this election. He was leading, not only was he leading all the candidates, he was leading at like 40% in the polls before this, but, and the next was Dukakis, who gets the nomination. He was beating Bush in the polls. Now, that could have changed, obviously. Go find his speech where he withdraws. He withdraws with indignation for the press. And actually, the reporters for the Miami Herald are really vilified for staking out this candidate. And it's called, like, the beginning of the downfall of journalism as far as covering the campaigns. Like, now they're going after scandals instead of just covering the candidates. But what struck me watching this is, and I know you probably have the same thoughts, it's crazy how they're making, even when Barbara Walters interviews Donna Rice, it's about Donna Rice's decision-making to get on the boat with Gary Hart, and it's about the press and her friend and, you know, her friend going to the press and why she shouldn't have done this. None of it is about the really poor decision-making of Gary Hart and the fact that he completely lied about this. And also the fact that his campaign had told him earlier, and it was leaking all over the place, that if Gary Hart can keep his pants on, he might be president. And he's seen as some, like, still like some iconic folk hero to the young folks. And he was still polling at like 30% after all this came out. Even when he withdrew, he was still leading.
Wow. I feel like you're burying the lead a little bit on this Democratic primary, because who else ran?
Joe Biden.
Joe Biden? I've heard of that guy.
Yeah. Well, Joe Biden withdrew before any of the primaries, but yeah,
Joe Biden ran for president in 1988. He was brought down by the plagiarism scandal.
That's
that was
right.
Actually mentioned in last week's vice presidential debate. Mike Pence said, when Biden talks about his coronavirus plan, he talks about testing and contact tracing, and those are things that we're already doing. So I think his plan sounds a little to me like plagiarism, which is something Joe Biden knows all about. This was the year, 1988. Biden got knocked out because he plagiarized his life story from somebody else who had a more interesting life story, I guess.
Sounds familiar. At the end of the day, the delegates go to, the majority of the delegates go to a guy named Michael Dukakis, the former, maybe he's the sitting governor, I don't see that right away, of Massachusetts.
All I remember about him is that he was a tank driver. He drove tanks, right?
I don't remember
he
that.
He didn't.
Okay. The runner-up was Jesse Jackson, again running for president, and he actually got only 700 less delegates than Dukakis, 1,700 to 1,000. So he did pretty well.
That's not too shabby.
No, he did pretty well in this election. Probably the best that he has done in any of the elections he's ran in. I don't know of any more than the last two, but that's it for the primaries. You have Dukakis winning the Democratic primary against H.W. Bush, the Republican winner.
Most importantly, you had Joe Biden withdrawing from the campaign because of plagiarism. Talk about the 2020 election so much, I've gone back and I've watched lots of coverage of Biden in 88, and they were very critical of him because he was known as a hothead who got all mad over everything. And they would say, his hotheadedness is going to bring him down because he's such a hothead. That's what they always called him, Biden the hothead.
Well, that's all I have on the primaries.
All right. General election. There's so many things in the general election, but it's a weird general election because it's the first time that it's really not run on the big issues. It's not run on having a plan for America. Roger Ailes, who was one of the comms guys for George H.W. Bush and later would become the creator of Fox News. And we remember him. He worked all the way back with Richard Nixon, so he had been around a long time.
Right.
He said that if you come up with a plan for America, that's your plan and your idea, and this is what you're going to do, that it's suicide, because the first thing that's going to happen is all the reporters are going to run to the other side and ask about your plan, and they're just going to have the opportunity to talk about what sucks about it and what a disaster it'll be. So it's better not to have a plan at all. This election is heavy on attacks. It's about attacking the other person. And it has one of the most famous attack ads of all time. After the Daisy Girl ad, which we talked about in the LBJ versus Goldwater election, probably the next one is the Willie Horton ad. And have you heard the Willie Horton ad before?
I have not, but you sent it to me, so I'm going to hear it for the first time.
Oh, sweet. That means you're about to hear it for the first time. So we'll get your reaction to it, having never heard it. Boom, play the Willie Horton ad.
Well, let me preface this by saying, by the way, I talked about this ad about maybe two episodes ago, because there's a guy named Lee Atwater that helped with the Reagan campaign back in 1980 when he first ran, and he is apparently the brains behind this Willie Horton attack ad.
He said he wanted to make Willie Horton Michael Dukakis' running mate, and then later, before he died, he apologized for saying that and for trying to do that, because he really felt bad about all this really harsh campaigning, it turned out.
Yep, and here it goes.
Bush and Dukakis on crime. Bush supports the death penalty for first-degree murderers. Dukakis not only opposes the death penalty, he allowed first-degree murderers to have weekend passes from prison. One was Willie Horton, who murdered a boy in a robbery, stabbing him 19 times. Despite a life sentence, Horton received 10 weekend passes from prison. Horton fled, kidnapped a young couple, stabbing the man and repeatedly raping his girlfriend. Weekend prison passes. Dukakis on crime.
What do you think?
Wow. Yeah, so it sounds like, I mean, Dukakis is just cool with releasing murderers for the weekend. As long as you're back on Monday.
It is a savage, savage ad that actually was not an uncommon practice to have those weekend passes type furloughs back then. Apparently, Reagan had done the same thing in California, and Bush had been a part of the same thing in Texas. But just the ad was savage. I mean, it's so, it has such grisly details in it.
Yeah.
And they're so coldly described.
It's like Bush opposes releasing murderers on the weekend. Dukakis?
Yeah.
Pro-releasing murderers on the weekend.
Many people have attributed the results of the election to that. It's not accurate. The real results of the election are, it's still a matter of the contrast between Jimmy Carter and the Democrats in the late 1970s, and then 8 years of Reagan, where everybody saw prosperity and it was wonderful. And that's what decided this election, not the Willie Horton ad or anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. People just didn't want to change at this point.
Yeah. I mean, why would you? There was no reason to want to change.
Plus,
at this point,
you're so close to remembering. Anybody that's still alive and voting probably remembers the Jimmy Carter administration, too, the Democrats. So not only do you have 8 good years of Bush, but you remember what it was like before that, you know?
Exactly. Exactly. It's all about that contrast. That's why Bush won, even though Bush is not in any way Ronald Reagan. He does promise to continue Reagan's economics, but if you remember when he ran against Reagan 8 years before this, he called it voodoo economics.
Yep, yep.
As anyone who has ever seen Ferris Bueller's Day Off knows, because that's what Ben Stein is teaching that class about.
About voodoo economics.
Yeah, he said, Vice President Bush called it, what, anyone, something D-O-O economics. Voodoo economics. Another thing sometimes people attribute Dukakis' loss to is, because the media never attributes anyone's losses to their policies. They always try to attribute it to some stupid nonsense.
If they're Democrats, let's be honest.
I mean, the real reason Dukakis lost is because Republican policies were bringing everyone prosperity after Democrat policies dragged the whole country down. So yeah, that's why Bush won. But one thing people attribute it to, and I sort of joked about this earlier, but I don't think you got it, was Michael Dukakis on the tank. Have you ever seen Michael Dukakis on the tank?
I have seen that. And if you want me to find that, it won't be that hard for me to find.
Well, I mean, there's no reason if you want to look at it, but it's not a video podcast, so we can't show it. And without showing it, it really has no value.
We will show it on Twitter somehow.
He's on this tank.
I see it. I'm looking at it right now.
He looks like a buffoon and he's got the hat on.
Yeah.
You know, like you had said earlier, he was small. He was a little guy. He was pretending to be something that he wasn't. And it really comes across that, oh, yes, this guy is in no way any sort of tank operator. But here he is on the tank for the photo op and he looks like a goon. The lesson is don't play dress up and don't pretend to be things that you are not.
His helmet looks too tight. He's wearing a chin strap that's almost over his mouth, not his chin. His face is contorted in this like weird smile / painful look, like he's actually sitting on an uncomfortable seat somehow. And he has this huge sticker that says Mike Dukakis across the top of the helmet, so there's no denying that it's him. Even if you didn't see the eyebrows, which, by the way, he was just known for, was the nose and the eyebrows.
So another thing that people chalk this up to, because there has to be some reason Dukakis lost other than policy.
Yep.
Another thing people chalk it up to is the question during the debate where Bernard Shaw from CNN asks, Mr. Dukakis, if Kitty Dukakis was raped and murdered, would you support the death penalty for the person who did it or whatever, right? And Dukakis just gives his death penalty answer like totally normal. He's totally not fazed by the question,
right,
or about the hypothetical being his wife being raped and murdered. It doesn't seem to faze him at all. Even he said that he blew it on that question. I think we have audio of that, right?
We do.
The first question goes to Governor Dukakis. You have 2 minutes to respond. Governor, if Kitty Dukakis were raped and murdered, would you favor an irrevocable death penalty for the killer?
No, I don't, Bernard, and I think you know that I've opposed the death penalty during all of my life. I don't see any evidence that it's a deterrent, and I think there are better and more effective ways to deal with violent crime. We've done so in my own state, and it's one of the reasons why we have had the biggest drop in crime of any industrial state in America, why we have the lowest murder rate of any industrial state.
People thought there should be some other reaction, like some sort of visceral reaction at the hypothetical.
Yes, you got to go. That's where you would have to go. If you're advising him about his campaign, or if you're a campaign advisor for Michael Dukakis, you have to say, if there's a personal question framed to question your views on something like the death penalty, you have to act indignant and essentially attack the audacity of the person asking the question.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's where you have to go.
You know who never would have messed that one up is Trump.
Yeah, probably not. He would just attack the reporter.
Yeah, exactly. He'd have gone after Bernard Shaw.
Yeah.
I think something else notable about this election is I think Bush won something like 59% of what we call the Reagan Democrats. And so, over time, as the Republican Party loses the Reagan Democrats, they lose their stronghold on the country. And, you know, in 1984, 49 states were red. Now begins the era of the Republicans losing that. And part of that is because of Ross Perot. And another part of it is because of somebody like Clinton coming along and really being much further to the right than people before, like Dukakis, like Mondale, if you go back further, Bill Clinton is just more to the center than any of those people were.
Yeah.
Or at least he ran more to the center.
And it really rings true with the next election. I realize there are other things that play into the fact that, that Clinton beats Bush in 92, and we're going to get to that. But if you really want to compete in 88, I think you have to run, and maybe Gary Hart was a good choice until the scandal happened, but you have to run someone that's not a Northeastern liberal. You just can't do that.
Yeah. Yeah,
if you want to win.
People from Massachusetts have not been successful running for president other than JFK.
That's true. I got another trivia question for you. It's not really a trivia question. It's just,
all right,
which president after George H.W. Bush won more of the popular vote as a percentage than George H.W. Bush against Michael Dukakis?
All right, let me think about it. Let me think about the big popular vote winners. I guess I would have to go Obama in 2008.
Okay, so you're close. In 08, Obama, he won 52.9%. The answer is nobody has won more percentage of the popular vote since George H.W. Bush in this election. Over 53%.
That question was a scam.
Complete scam, but
you set me up. I'm a patsy.
Exactly. Bush
in 88. It would have had to be Obama 2008. That would be the only one that could touch it.
Yeah, it's really close. I mean,
all right, let's go to the map.
Wait, let's talk about one more thing I want to ask you about.
Oh, okay.
Let's talk about the vice presidential debate really quick.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
I totally have that in my notes, and I just wanted to skip over it. You want to tell the story?
No, you tell it. I just wanted to remind you about it.
Okay. Senator Benson was the vice presidential candidate on Dukakis's ticket, and he had to debate Dan Quayle, who was the vice presidential nominee. It obviously went on to become vice president. Dan Quayle was only 41 years old, which is really young. It's younger than anybody who's ever been president. Even Theodore Roosevelt was 42. So Dan Quayle was only 41 years old, and he didn't even look 41 years old. He looked 26 years old. So they got to talking about Dan Quayle's experience. Dan Quayle said, you know, it's not about how old you are or how long you've been around. It's about what kind of experience you have. And I have as much experience as Jack Kennedy did, John F. Kennedy did in the Congress. And Benson delivers what is one of the most cold-blooded lines in debate history.
Yep.
Or, you know, at least was until recently. he says, Senator, I served with Jack Kennedy. I knew Jack Kennedy. Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine. Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy. And I mean, it took the air right out of Dan Quayle.
Yeah, what do you say back to that?
I know, he said that was really uncalled for. And it really was. It was just nasty. The other side went down, which is fine with me. I'm not a particular fan of George H.W. Bush or bringing back the moderate Republicans of the sort of, you know, Ford, Nixon, Eisenhower ilk. I very much prefer the Ronald Reagan style, but
yeah,
it comes and goes so quickly.
It's really interesting that this is probably the most iconic debate moment from 1988 is the vice presidential debate. And that's really the one line that you remember.
That's one of the most iconic debate moments of all time.
All right. Do you want to do the map now?
All right. Yeah. It's not 49 red states like it was in 1984. The Republicans lost Washington, never to have it back again. They lost Oregon, never to have it back again. They lost Minnesota, never to have it back again. They lost Iowa and Wisconsin, never to have those back again until 2016, I believe. Iowa may have gone for a Republican in the interim. I can't remember, but I'm pretty sure this is the last time a Republican wins Wisconsin until Trump. West Virginia, the Republicans lost, and they don't get that back until 2004. And New York, Massachusetts, Rhode Island, and D.C., and I don't think they ever get any of those back again.
I don't know if you have this, too, but there are states that the Republican candidate Bush won in this election that it's the last time a Republican won those states. And that is California, Illinois, New Jersey, Maryland, Connecticut, Maine, which they've won parts of Maine, obviously, Delaware, or Vermont. He's the last Republican candidate to win those states.
And I missed Hawaii. Hawaii was also blue here, never to be won by Republicans again. But they'll win them all again someday because the pendulum always swings. You feel like they're lost forever, but they're not. Eventually, these states will be Republican again. Some Republican states will be blue again. You know, we don't live at the end of history, but you feel like you do. Like nothing will ever change again, but it will. How was your beer? I want to hear about the vanilla porter and how you liked it.
It's gone. I finished it. And not to say that I don't finish most of my beers, but I don't finish some of my beers. And this beer, it actually isn't what I would pull from the shelf, but because it had vanilla, I wanted to try it because I do like the vanilla cream ales. And I would drink it again. I like it.
On a scale of 1 to delicious.
That's about a 7.
All right.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
All right. Yeah. That's high because it goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 delicious.
Yeah, it's right behind Jake's beer from last episode.
All right, play us out, Matt.
Yeah. All right, so you can find us on social media. Please go do that. You can find us, we're Election and Beer on Twitter, on Parler, on Facebook, and also, if you're not listening to us on a podcast app, you got to do that. Download a podcast app, subscribe to our podcast. That way you can get all of our past episodes. If you haven't listened to those, you're missing a lot of stuff. You're missing a lot of history. Listen to our current episode, and then you'll be notified whenever we have a new episode that comes out, which is every Tuesday, ideally. And then we'll see you again next time for the election of 1992. Come back then.